Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And now I want to take you back in time a couple of weeks. We're headed back to Election Day 2018, when Red Red Kansas elected Democrats to office, notably a Democratic governor. People across the country were freaking out. Conservative commentator Ann Coulter took to Twitter with the proclamation that Kansas was dead to her. The tweet got a lot of traction, so I asked a couple of political scientists whether reports of the death of conservative Kansas might have been a wee bit exaggerated.
Yes.
Yes. Kansas is not a purple state, no. Folks. Kansas is still a Republican state. Democrats can win, but it's not blue, it's not purple.
But this election season was still a doozy in Kansas, and leading up to it, we put the governor's race in context with a podcast from the Kansas News Service called My Fellow Kansans. That podcast is back with a final episode looking back on what happened. Let's listen.
We certainly have our fingers crossed that he wins.
Yes, we do.
But there's no sure things in anything, so
going into Election Day, we saw the numbers of people have been early voting and had a nice little spread of Republicans over Democrats.
But I'm nervous that Western Kansas is going to, like, mess it up, so.
It became very clear to me that I had to stick this out to the end. Every vote that we get, as far as I'm concerned, is a win.
I think some Republicans who are a little bit relieved actually they're losing. Any reaction to that?
I don't know why they would be.
If you look at a map of the state of Kansas, a heck of a lot more red than blue, but you look at those counties that are the populous counties, and they are very blue in terms of election results.
Ecstatic! I'm just so happy because I didn't think, like, I thought Kobach was going to win because this is Kansas, like, Trump country.
We fought the good fight. I think we fought really well.
What a night for Kansas. Oh,
this is historic. This is crazy. This is amazing.
All right, here we go.
I'm Jim McLean, and this is My Fellow Kansans, a podcast from the Kansas News Service.
Chris Kobach just went down to defeat in Kansas.
Really? Did you just get a call? Whoa.
Yeah, we're calling it right now.
The election is over. This pivotal election we thought might show us whether Kansas is still traveling on that red state path to the right or headed back toward the center. On this episode, we'll get some interpretations from people across the political spectrum who've been right in the middle of things this campaign season. The outcome did surprise some people. Rachel Maddow, for example.
Wow. Kansas. Okay, this is a big deal. Chris Kobach you have heard of because Chris Kobach became a figure in the Trump administration without ever officially joining it. He was brought to Washington to head up the voter fraud task force.
Sure, I suppose it's a bit surprising. In electing Democratic State Senator Laura Kelly, Kansas joins a small handful of states to have a woman as governor for the third time. But the electing a Democrat part of it, well, Kansas hasn't elected back-to-back Republican governors since the 1960s. So switching from red to blue at the top, it's really nothing new. Kansas is just sticking to its roots. Remember in our first episode, we talked about the DNA of Kansas.
And think to yourself, there's no place like home. There's no place like home. There's no place like home.
Historically, a commitment to public education at the community and state levels has been one of the things that makes Kansas, Kansas. It's baked into the state's identity and its politics.
But Kansas was where we wanted to raise our daughters. Strong communities, great public schools.
It's one of the reasons that Laura Kelly and her husband decided to move here decades ago. And it's the issue that animated her campaign for governor.
So to me, Sam Brownback's massive education cuts weren't numbers on a spreadsheet. They were an attack on who we are as Kansans. That's why I'm running for
Kelly,
governor.
A Democrat representing a majority Republican district in the state Senate, believed that Kansas had gone off the rails, that former Republican Governor Sam Brownback's failed tax-cutting experiment and his hard-right politics had somehow broken the state. And after some soul-searching, she concluded she could fix it. She won the governor's race, defeating Republican Secretary of State Chris Kobach, a self-described full-throttle conservative who, like Brownback, promised to cut taxes and spending.
You know, there will be a lot of talk around America about the blue wave. But I don't believe that's what's happened here in Kansas. What happened in Kansas was a wave of common sense. A wave of bipartisanship. This wasn't one side beating the other. It was Democrats and Republicans and independents all coming together to put our state back on track.
Kelly says it was a wave of common sense. But KU political scientist Patrick Miller says what washed over Kansas, particularly its urban centers, was fear about Kris Kobach, Kansas's version of President Donald Trump.
Look at his negatives. For a Republican in Kansas to have had 45 to 55% negative perceptions amongst voters consistently in polls.
Yeah, even coming into the race.
Yeah, is pretty astounding. And, you know, one thing we saw throughout the race is he actually started off with a fair number of voters who didn't know who he was. I mean, those of us who follow politics, we of course know who Kris Kobach is, but a lot of Kansans had to learn about him. And as they learned about him, his negatives didn't change. You know, whatever happened to produce Kobach as the nominee, he was someone who could not capitalize on the Republican nature of Kansas. And, you know, I think we also need to remember that Kansas is more Republican than it is conservative.
That's an interesting distinction. What does it mean?
Well, about half of Kansans identify as Republicans, but over 60% of Kansans identify as moderate or liberal, actually, in polling, if you ask them. Of course, that skews heavily towards moderate. And conservatives are still the largest of the three ideological groups. But, you know, again, there are a lot of people out there who have historically voted Republican, but they're not Brownback and they're not Kobach kind of conservatives.
And Laura Kelly appealed directly to those voters with endorsements from the likes of former Governors Bill Graves, Mike Hayden, former U.S. Senators Nancy Kassebaum and Sheila Fromm, who all fit very neatly into that moderate wing of the Republican Party, all of whom came out very publicly and said, vote for Kelly, not Kobach.
Right.
Well, that's one thing for a political scientist or a reporter like me to say that made a difference in the race. It's quite another to hear it from Jim Joyce, the executive director of the Kansas Republican Party. When several GOP icons endorsed Kelly, Bill Graves and Nancy Kassebaum among them, Kobach's communication director dismissed them as tired has-beens. That, Joyce says, was tone deaf.
You know, imagine just if after one of those endorsements he said, shoot, that's a bummer. I hope I can count on their expertise when I'm actually governing the state. You know, every time someone's against you doesn't mean they're a has-been or they're, you know, they don't deserve the respect or they weren't elected by the same people that you're trying to get elected by. I couldn't believe that that was said about former senators.
When I talked to him a few days after the election, Joyce said Kobach's biggest mistake was thinking he could win the governor's race by simply turning out his conservative base.
It wasn't a very well-ran campaign. Kind of the blocking and tackling, just top to bottom, wasn't really done. And he didn't reach out to new voters, really.
Well, let me just say on behalf of all of Kansas, President Trump, welcome to Trump country.
Cheering supporters did fill the Topeka Expo Center for Trump's rally for Kobach in October.
I'm so glad that America has a president who gets it and knows that illegal means illegal.
But those voters chanting build the wall didn't even get Kobach 50% of the primary vote. And Joyce says clearly weren't enough to put Kobach over the top in November. I think what I'm hearing you say is that that base that really likes to hear that, you need to go beyond that base at least a little bit to win statewide elections. Is that what
absolutely.
I hear?
Absolutely. And if you're going to govern, you know,
yeah,
you absolutely cannot only cater to one base. And that's just an ineffective way to do it and really just an arrogant way to think about it.
You can't refute the fact that Kansas has been moving right politically for the last 30 years. What do the results in 2016 and the results in 2018 mean relative to that really big picture question as to where Kansas is headed politically? Has it stopped that rightward trajectory and started to cycle back a little bit to the middle, or are we still on the same path?
I think this stopped it a little bit, and people understand that, you know, maybe the firebrand, you might like what you're hearing. It might fire you up, but it's not going to win. And if we're not winning, then what's the point? I mean, losers don't legislate. We've got a Democrat who's in control of the state right now.
We definitely have people who crossed over party lines or just crossed into our party lines.
To Brooklyn Mosley, who coordinated Get Out the Vote efforts for Democrats across Kansas, the crossover voting by Republicans and the high turnout in cities, suburbs, and college towns were signs that voters were energized and ready to shake things up. What was driving that this year?
We've been living with some of the regressive tax policy and trickle-down economics, and I think that Kansas was just taking the first step forward, saying, hey, we've already lived with this, and like we're just going to fix Kansas right now.
What I hear you saying is that you think Kansas voters intentionally took a step back toward the center.
They took a step back towards having a functioning Kansas, so if it's called being in the center, then yes, we can say that.
Just 4 years ago, Mosley was working on Paul Davis's campaign when he nearly unseated former Governor Brownback. Now, Democrats were very optimistic about how that race might go, but Davis lost it by 30,000 votes, less than 4 points.
I was very naive in 2014, so I definitely had a lot of optimism. This year, I definitely had guarded optimism. I didn't think a lot of the races would be called as early as they did. When we found out that Senator Kelly won the governor's race, I was still in my tank top and jeans because I was in the war room all day. And so I ran down the stairs and I was like, oh my gosh, this happened. So I knew that we were going to win some. I just didn't know what we were going to win.
Along with winning the governor's office, Democrats held their ground in the state house and picked up a congressional seat in the Kansas City area. First-time candidate Sharice Davids defeated a four-term Republican with a lot of phone banking and an eye-popping bio. She's a first-generation college student, will be one of the first two Native American women in Congress, and the first openly gay person to represent Kansas in Washington.
We have the opportunity to reset expectations about what people think when they look at Kansas.
This year's results are a further indication that Kansas is in the midst of a big demographic and electoral shift. While turnout in rural parts of the state was flat compared to the last midterms, voters in urban and suburban areas were excited about the candidates at the top of the ticket, and turnout was up in those places. And that's why Laura Kelly needed only 9 of Kansas's 105 counties to take the governorship. KU's Patrick Miller says Kansas isn't transitioning from red to blue, but certain parts of it, the parts where most of the people live, are trending purple.
Kansas is, to be sure, still a Republican state, and as the Republican Party has been going right nationally, it's been going right in Kansas, and we've seen our politics track that. But yet, the pattern of suburbia becoming more friendly to Democrats, rural America becoming more friendly to Republicans, we see that as well.
The urban-rural political divide, it's deepening.
Looking at the map, geography is easy to see. It's sexy. You can paint it in red and blue, and it's easy to visually grasp. Mm-hmm. But geography also is a stand-in for a lot of the demographics that actually do divide what suburban versus rural populations look like. And some of those big divides are race, college education level, income, religiosity. Mm-hmm. And all of those things map onto party in some way. So really in the last 20 years, but it's become starkly evident in the last 2 to 4 years, the Democratic Party is becoming more of the party of suburbia and urban areas. And the Republican Party is becoming more of the party of rural to suburban areas.
The moderate Republicans of Kansas we've talked so much about on this podcast, they're mostly in that suburban category. They remain important. Kelly, for instance, couldn't have won without those voters, but they're verging on extinction.
Just as conservative Democrats have disappeared and become Republicans or taken their politics with them to the grave, moderate liberal Republicans are also disappearing. They've disappeared in Congress. They're disappearing in public opinion polls.
It's what political scientists like Miller call a realignment. Such major shifts are important, and they've happened before.
What happened in the South, or what happened in New England when moderate Republicans started to disappear there, is that you had those, say, conservative Southern Democrats or liberal Northern Republicans starting to vote for the other party at the federal level, but they found themselves able to vote for people of their traditional party locally. The South started to transition at the presidential level in the 1950s, and it didn't fully realign to the voting Republican down to the level of state legislatures and sheriffs and city council people until about 2010. That transition to realigning up and down the ballot, it took decades. Where will these traditionally moderate Republicans who would like a Nancy Kassenbaum, but they have a Kris Kobach or a Donald Trump, where are they going to land? I mean, knowing that could take 20 years. They're probably going to become friendlier to Democrats. It doesn't mean they're all going to become Democrats. But I think you can see that transition just looking at Johnson County, for example, and how hard Democratic it did go the other day.
Johnson County in Metro Kansas City is the state's most populous county. It is as good a place as any to see the countervailing forces pulling at Kansas politics from both ends. In the governor's race, Laura Kelly won Johnson County by a mile. At the same time, moderate Republicans lost some legislative seats there, some to Democrats and some to more conservative Republicans.
I wasn't surprised that they put somebody up against me. I knew that was coming.
Joy Kostin was one of several Johnson County moderates to win a Kansas House seat in the backlash election of 2016. And when she voted to roll back Brownback's income tax cuts, Kostin believed she was doing what her constituents wanted her to do, to fund public schools and to put the state back on sound financial footing. But it landed her on the target lists for the Kansas Chamber and Americans for Prosperity, both conservative groups backed by Wichita's Koch brothers. And their effort to oust her started long before this year's Republican primary.
Americans for Prosperity immediately started targeting us. So I had 7 postcards against me in my first year. And it wasn't even election year. Every single month, I had a postcard about how I had done these horrible things. And it's very hard to combat those kinds of misinformation.
Anti-abortion activists also targeted Kostin for her votes.
I voted against 2 bills in my 2 years as a legislator that were deemed pro-life votes. One of them had to do with adoption.
Oh, that bill.
And somehow that got me in the crosshairs.
Yeah, you're talking about the bill that was written for groups that are religiously affiliated,
right,
and allowed them to continue to provide adoptions and foster care placements,
right,
placements, et cetera, in a way that they didn't have to violate their strongly held religious beliefs.
Right.
Kostin thought the bill would allow discrimination against gay and lesbian couples and non-Christians seeking to adopt or foster children.
In the final hour of debate on the floor, the carrier of the bill came forward and said, "We've just got word from the Kansans for Life that this is a pro-life bill, meaning if you vote against it, Kansans for Life will be after you. You will be postcarded." And it changed the vote. It absolutely changed the vote.
Kelly Warren, a candidate backed by Kansans for Life and the Kansas Chamber, swamped Kostin in the August primary. Kostin accepts the defeat, but doesn't believe it signals a sudden right turn by voters in her district.
I don't believe that my district is far right. I don't believe that my district will stand still if the policies that are put forward are too far from the centrist ideal of Kansas. I could be totally wrong, but I don't think so.
You know, a lot of people make that argument that the legislature is more conservative than the people of Kansas. What evidence is there for that?
I live with the people of Kansas.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I know my neighbors and I know my friends. And yes, we have different ideas, different opinions. They all are still pretty down-to-earth people. They want good schools for their kids. They want good roads and bridges. They want the basics that government is supposed to provide. They're not looking for a handout. They're not looking for anything beyond, you know, what they can't do for themselves. But it's been so politicized for so long, and I think that everyone is just hyper sensitive to all the persuasive messages that we get every single day on both sides of the aisle. And maybe it's a little bit Pollyanna of me. I still believe that most people are just down-to-earth people.
In other words, Kansas common sense. Perhaps partisans across the spectrum could agree that's the Kansas tradition. Even so, they would have different ways of defining it. For Democrat Brooklyn Mosley, getting to that middle common sense place means toning down the red on Kansas's electoral map.
One thing that I actually learned from like being able to travel across the state is that there's Democrats everywhere. And like even though those rural counties, it's very difficult for us to like get inroads. A lot of that is just being there and like having organization. Like Johnson County didn't go blue overnight. So yes, the map was very red now, but we're working on it to like get it at least a light shade of purple.
But Republican Jim Joyce says maybe making it a slightly lighter shade of red is all it would take. He continues to insist that this year's results, particularly in Johnson County, were an aberration, not evidence of a fundamental shift.
You know, I think this really is just a referendum on Trump and Brownback, and there's a lot of bad blood and a bad taste in people's mouth in Johnson County. And once they really get a feel for what those Democrat policies are, what Sharice Davids is all about, and what Laura Kelly's all about, I think they're going to be coming back pretty quickly. I mean, certainly it's on us to have the right message and to court them correctly and to not be as abrasive as maybe some recent candidates were. But it's ours for the taking, absolutely.
Finally, and perhaps most importantly, Laura Kelly, the woman elected to lead Kansas for the next 4 years, has her own take on what it means to govern in the Kansas tradition.
Kansans sent a loud and clear message. They want their leaders to work together, despite political labels. And that is exactly what I plan to do. I will not waste time or taxpayer dollars on partisan fights. The rebuilding process will not be easy. We all know we have a very long, challenging road ahead of us. But if we work together, then truly the sky is the limit.
So at least for now, my fellow Kansans, let's leave our conversation in that hopeful and aspirational place.
That was Jim McLean with the Kansas News Service. And I want to thank all the people who brought us that podcast, my fellow Kansans. It's been great having them with us to put what happened this election season in perspective. Up next, it hasn't just been election season. It's also been marching band season. And there's more to the whole marching band scene than you might think. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard. And right now, high school football teams are gearing up for state championships. But so are the local marching bands. And the Friday Night Lights experience that so many communities relish would not be complete without marching bands. Our intern, Sophia Gillespie, went out on a mission to learn what it takes to just kill it at halftime. And she found out that the whole marching band thing is about a lot more than music.
We all know marching bands play the fight song during halftime and after every touchdown, keeping the spectator spirits high throughout the game, even through the cold and the rain. But did you know that there are also games just for marching bands?
Carrollton Trojan Marching Band, the field is yours for exhibition.
David Phillips is the high school band director for Carrollton and the festival director for Band Day.
I've been organizing Band Day for 14 years, but it's been going for 49 years.
Band Day is a festival that brings together 62 bands from all over northern Missouri, ranging from Kansas City to St. Louis, to compete. It is a perfect sunny 75-degree day with not a cloud in the sky. School buses roll up throughout the day, dropping off dozens of students with their instruments and uniforms, which, according to some Oak Grove students, are less than cushy.
It's really hot and sweaty.
Really, really hot. Really sweaty and really itchy.
It's so scratchy and uncomfortable.
But it's worth it.
It is worth it.
Students also show up with their school pride, determination seeping out of their pores. The town of Macon, located about an hour west of Hannibal, is a formidable force in the Missouri high school marching band scene. With a population of 5,500, Macon has won grand champion at Carrollton Band Day 10 out of the past 13 years. Darren Culliver is one of Macon's bass drum players. Surrounded by 85 bandmates, Darren is sounding fairly confident.
We have pretty good music this year, and have worked very hard to march.
And what songs will you be playing?
I just learned the name of the show like a couple weeks ago, so I don't know that.
What should we expect out on the field today?
Greatness.
The stands are packed with parents decked out in T-shirts that proudly state things like, "I'm with the band," or "parent of a rock star." Right now, Warrensburg High School is in formation out on the field. About 100 students clad in red and white uniforms with long black plumes sticking out of their hats. The three drum majors, however, are all wearing various spy outfits, one of which is the colorful Austin Powers. Five judges sit in the press box, each with a special focus on the show at hand: music, marching, percussion, color guard, and general effect. Anthony Purcell judges that last category. He is the director of bands at the University of Central Missouri.
That's essentially how does the band perform musically and also with any kind of body movement, whether it's the drill related or just with their feet, and how that relates to the audience.
So what do you look for in a good performance?
Oh, good question. how well are they executing together? You know, do they all move together? Do they all stop together? But generally in this category, because it is such a hodgepodge category, I kind of look at how are they affecting the audience? Are they playing with emotion that makes sense?
Marching bands have not always been used to engage spectators and rally school spirit. Roger Kugler is the director of the International Center of Music at Park University. He says that marching bands originated in times of war to send signals across vast distances.
They would also lead the troops in marching from one place to another, not necessarily obviously in combat, but just to keep people in step and moving in time and moving together. And getting it would lift the men's spirits, and they would feel better about marching along together, and even would sing along to popular tunes and things like that as they marched.
After World War I, with the introduction of the radio in the 1920s, the need for marching bands to signal and communicate strategic moves became obsolete. However, instead of calling it quits, marching bands began to fill roles in ceremonies and even became therapeutic. Mike Corrigan makes and repairs brass instruments in Kansas City. He knows a lot about band history.
A lot of these soldiers were in the trenches in the worst possible, worst imaginable situation fighting in a war. And when they came back after the war ended, it was kind of a shock for a lot of these soldiers. Drum and bugle corps started as a way for them to do something collectively and execute something together as a team.
These organized groups started in VFW posts and American Legions and spread to high schools and colleges.
The field shows we think about at halftime essentially evolved from drum and bugle corps.
Nowadays, Mike says, marching band is a staple of American football culture.
At halftime, that's an opportunity for the athletes to take a break. And it just logistically made perfect sense for the marching band to actually perform. And when you have a football field that's mapped out and gridded, it made a lot of sense for them to actually use the grid as a way of basically setting different pictures and things like that.
And now we also have huge marching band competitions like Carrollton Band Day, where they still march in military style. The Color Guard and dance teams even twirl props like swords, sabers, and guns. But just because they march in military style doesn't mean the theme of the show has to be warlike. Warrensburg High School band director Stephanie Sikelski says her school's performance has a spies theme.
So you'll see and hear music from Mission Impossible, Skyfall from James Bond, and then Soul Bossa Nova from Austin Powers.
Is there anything special to watch out for?
We're going to be dancing our booties off during Soul Bossa Nova.
And they definitely did. Macon High School is doing a pirate theme. The drum major is wearing a sea captain's outfit, complete with a long red jacket, triangle hat with large white feather, and black leather boots. He stands on top of a chest filled with shiny treasure while the band marches in waves around the field. These field shows are intricate performances with lots of moving parts. Instrumentalists, color guard, dance team, props. How are these shows even made? Sarah Corrigan is a field show choreographer, and yes, she's married to Mike Corrigan. Band directors come to her with music and a vague idea, and she takes it from there.
I did a show last year about arachnophobia, so I did a shape that looked like a spider. And the audience can visually see that spider. But you have to be careful when you're doing some shapes like that sometimes, because you have to pay attention to what instrument is moving around.
But we are getting ahead of ourselves. The first thing Sarah does is divide the score into natural sections or phrases and think about what can happen during those moments in the music. Her job is really about making the music come to life visually. Once she has found good points for breaks and changes, she moves to plotting out the show on specially designed marching band software.
This is Pieware 3D Basic. You can tell who is who because each of the letters represents something different. So a C is clarinet, M is mellophone, A is alto sax.
She plugs in the band specifications to detail, number of members, types of instruments, school colors, and even the mascot on the field. Then she gets to work creating the drill sets, which are the individual pictures you see during a performance.
Some shows with a band that doesn't have as much experience in marching, they might only have maybe 15 drill sets in a whole show. But for a lot of them that I write for, they'll have more like 30 sets in a song. So it can be, you know, up to 60 plus sets in your whole show.
In other words, that is a lot of running around the field. But not only are they just running around, they are keeping time, marching 170 beats a minute for 7 minutes straight. They are also playing challenging music, and carrying instruments.
A flute is a lighter weight instrument, so they might be able to move further easier, but the sousaphones are the big ones that wrap around your body, and you can't necessarily always take bigger steps with that.
These students and their directors and choreographers rehearse hours before and after school, and even weeks in the summer months, to prepare their field shows for halftime and for competitions like Carrollton Band Day.
Is your band ready? The band is ready.
Ken Greiner is a retired high school band director of 30 years. He knows from experience why students volunteer for such a time-consuming and strenuous activity.
Because they love it. They love the whole idea about it. And they get the crowd reaction. I mean, it's impressive.
Much like it was used as a way to foster camaraderie with fellow soldiers in times of war, today's marching band, over 100 years after the end of World War I, is still a place for high school students to form relationships with one another. Rue Grimsley is a flute player from Oak Grove High.
It's my passion. Like, music has been my passion for forever, and it helps me channel all of the bad things into my marching and being better and great. Our band is just like a huge little family.
And it is very entertaining to watch this family perform. Gary Grigsby has been announcing the bands at Carrollton Band Day since the early 1980s. He has seen a lot of change over the years.
Oh, the bands are becoming much more professional. Their musicianship has greatly increased. And we're seeing, every year, we're seeing it increase a notch in competitiveness.
But David Phillips, the organizer of Carrollton Band Day, knows that marching is so much more than just a way to get a trophy.
You know, for me, it's an opportunity for the kids to be successful, all the kids to be successful. We don't put anybody on the bench. We have them all out there. They're all contributing 100%, doing the very best job they can.
After 9 long hours of competition and judge deliberation, it is finally time for the award ceremony. The stands and surrounding area are jam-packed with band members and their parents. The drum majors, still in full costume, are lined up on the football field, proud representatives of their high schools.
And now, for the grand champion, this year's winner, drum roll, please. And you got it. It's Maker!
Everyone is out here high in spirits, building community, and making music. But it is also fun to win.
Our intern, Sophia Gillespie, brought us that story about the local marching band scene, and she tells us that the Golden Regiment Marching Band from Blue Springs will be playing in the Macy's Day Thanksgiving Parade in New York City this year. So incredible. Keep an eye out for them if you're watching the parade from home on TV. I'm Gina Kaufman. Speaking of Thanksgiving, Central Standard will be right back with some holiday entertaining tips. Don't go away. I'm Gina Kaufman, this is KCUR's Central Standard, and now holiday gatherings may be on your mind, whether you're a guest or a host. And for the hosts out there, something worth considering if you haven't already, guests with mobility issues might be stressed out just thinking about how they'll navigate your front walk, your entryway, and that lovely buffet you spent hours setting up. So now we're going to get advice from someone at KU's Research and Training Center on Independent Living. She has just assembled a guide on this very topic. Dot Neri, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us. What inspired you to look into wheelchair accessibility at parties in people's homes?
Well, I have both professional and personal interests. I'm a disability researcher, and I've also used a wheelchair for over 30 years. So this is an issue I've encountered, and I know from my research on this topic that many other wheelchair users, people with other mobility limitations, often get excluded from events that are held in private homes. So we created this resource to help people navigate that situation.
Your guide begins with this lovely reflection on the importance of gatherings around the holidays or otherwise. You write, "Humans are social creatures. We are hardwired to connect with one another, to gather and create shared experiences." Can you talk a little bit more about the importance of being able to attend parties?
Well, you know, think about what happens over the holidays. We like to get together. We try to catch up with each other. We strengthen those bonds. We learn about who's doing what, who's traveled where, who got a new job, who's getting married. And if people who have mobility issues cannot make those connections, we miss out on so much. Not just the people who may not be able to attend, but the families, the friends who can't have them in their homes. So our guide is geared toward helping people have those conversations about how can we make this happen together, and then remediating barriers that might be impediments to gathering.
What are some of the things hosts who have never used a wheelchair might not think about despite all their best intentions?
Well, they might not realize that one step is a barrier for somebody who uses a wheelchair or a walker. They might not know that every person is different, and what one wheelchair user might be willing to do, be carried in, might not be appropriate for someone else. They might not know that a gravel path could be a huge impediment, or simply that moving furniture can create an accessible path within the home so everybody can join in. So we've got some very simple suggestions that can help people figure out how to make those gatherings happen and to include everybody.
You outlined three main components of what you call visitability. What are they?
They are a step-free entrance anywhere in the home. Could be front, back, garage, anywhere. Accessible path to the entrance, an accessible path within the home, and an accessible bathroom on the level where people are gathering. And I'm going to make a disclaimer there. The bathroom is often the most difficult because of the fixed nature of the furnishings. So we provide suggestions on, you know, maybe people don't have to use a bathroom if they make the visit shorter. There's a lot of ways to deal with that. And not every home can be made accessible, but most can.
Yeah, I mean,
on a temporary basis.
I do want to raise that issue that some things about our homes can be easily rearranged. Other things can't for just one evening or whatever. Do you have advice for sort of proactively and graciously talking to a guest about how you might help them in the space, or like you were saying, how you can do it together?
Well, I think it depends on the nature of the relationship. If I'm going to a colleague's home for a holiday cocktail party, I'm probably not going to get to down to the level of talking about the bathroom. But if I'm going to my sister's house for Thanksgiving, then I might want to talk about how we can figure out that situation. And for some people, it's making a shorter visit, a couple of hours. It might be knowing where there's a public bathroom nearby that could be used. Or in the case of a family member, it might be something like putting a commode in a bedroom. So it really depends on the nature of the relationship and the visit.
Share a couple of the pieces of advice that you think would apply to the largest number of our listeners planning parties.
Well, in terms of a pathway, if you have a muddy path or a gravel path, what some people have done is to get a large appliance cardboard box from an appliance store, which is usually free, cut it up and lay it down over the mud or the gravel. That can create an accessible path for someone to use. Another idea for steps, if you have a couple of steps, might be to rent or borrow a portable ramp. A local independent living center, a rental agency, a state of assistive technology program might have a ramp you could borrow or rent. Or simply a piece of plywood could be used as long as there's someone to help navigate the ramp in that way. Another thing is, you know, people don't realize that a strategically placed plant that looks very nice could be moved in order to allow access for somebody using a walker to avoid someone tripping on it. There's a lot of simple things that can be done to make an environment accessible. If someone can't pull their knees under a table, you might use an extra tray or lift the table up with some blocks. Simple things, but they can make an environment much more welcoming.
What about some subtler questions to ask, not just about the physical space, but when you just think about the larger picture of hosting? Like, if you want to make it not just possible for someone to accept your invitation, but comfortable, welcoming, stress-free. I mean, I'll just share something from my own experience. I have accompanied people in wheelchairs to parties, and one thing that I have observed being helpful is if you've got a sit-down dinner, making sure a guest in a wheelchair won't have to ask other people to move, which it seems like the best way to do that is assigned seating and some thoughtfulness about that so that nobody's got to come to the party and then start saying, oh, excuse me, could I please have that place where you just sat, etc.?
Well, you make a good point, because no one wants to go into a friendly social situation and have to advocate. So that's a good point. I think you make a good suggestion. Assigned seating is good, because that way everybody knows where they're supposed to sit, and there'll be a space available. I think perhaps the most important thing is for the host and the guest to talk beforehand, to strategize about any situations that may come up. And that could be everything from getting into the home to having a place to sit within the social circle and not be isolated, say, behind the sofa because there's no place to go. But again, that depends on a nice conversation. And we offer in the resource, we offer some sort of icebreakers to begin talking about that. Because, you know, traditionally, people have not wanted to criticize someone's home. And guests have felt hosts may have felt guilty about, gee, my home is not accessible. Most homes are not. We don't have a lot of accessible housing stock in this nation. So the fact that people negotiate inaccessible homes fairly routinely, so both the host and the guests may have suggestions about how to make that happen. But if those conversations don't happen, then the visit often doesn't happen. And that's what we emphasize at the start of the resource.
Can you give an example of an icebreaker? Because I think, you know, hosts might be reluctant to bring it up because they don't want to make someone feel singled out, and guests might be reluctant to bring it up, as you said, because you're a guest and you don't want to put what feels like a demand on a host.
Sure. Well, for example, the guest might say, my brother's home has steps and house. Here's how I get in there in my wheelchair. And then they could talk about possible ways to make that happen. Or the host might say, you know, we really want you to come to our party. Let's talk about how we can accommodate you and what we need to do. There are 7 steps up to our front door. We know that's too hard, but we could have the dinner in our daylight basement, which is around a path to the back, and there's no steps there. The guest could say, you know, if I just stop by for a few hours, I won't need to use a bathroom, so we don't need to worry about that. So some personal disclosure, some assessment of the home can make things happen that haven't been able to happen before.
You know, you mentioned a little while ago that it's important to remember that what works for one person in a wheelchair or has worked for one person in a wheelchair might not work for another. Can you talk about some of the just range of experience that people might have? Because I think that pitfall of assuming that, oh, I've seen this, I know what works,
sure,
I've done it before.
Well, for example, I'm not a real large person, and I have a 30-pound lightweight manual wheelchair. So using a piece of plywood for me to get up a step or two is not that difficult with some help. If I were a really big 250-pound guy in a power wheelchair that weighs a couple hundred pounds, that may not be the best way. It may not be durable enough, so you might want to get a real portable ramp. I'm not saying that wouldn't happen, but you want to kind of assess what would be the best option there. A person in a walker may have the ability to negotiate a step. So again, you shouldn't assume that what works for one person works for another. People have different needs. They have different experience. If someone's fallen before, they may be less willing to be helped up several stairs without a ramp. And if it's a person who's got a heavy piece of equipment, that creates different needs as well. So again, everybody's individual, and those conversations need to happen.
Do you, in your research, do you encounter that sometimes people just aren't invited because of the assumption that they can't get in?
I think that happens a lot. And in fact, I did a small research study a few years ago, and I interviewed 16 people with different types of equipment, different access needs, different types of disabilities. And the overriding finding was that people do feel excluded. Some people will do whatever they need to get in. They'll be carried in. They'll find a ramp. But for a lot of people, those conversations are not happening, and there's a lot of hurt. And one person said, you know, I mainly have business type relationships because I meet people in coffee shops because I often can't get into their homes, which is pretty sad. And, you know, another person, and I love this quote, we included it in the resource, people's homes are the museums of their lives, and we often don't get to see them. So when you think of how you decorate your home, the photos you have out, the things you choose to display, and people don't get to see that side of their friends, their relatives often.
It's a form of getting to know someone and connecting.
It sure is. It sure is. And when we think about connecting, you know, how do people get jobs? They often get them through people they know, through networking. You might be at a holiday party and hear, oh, somebody's got an opening. And if people with disabilities don't have the opportunity to experience that, they don't get to have some of those opportunities that other people have.
Is the timing of your guide to making a home visitable, is that coordinated with the holidays?
Well, we actually publish it during the summer because there's several national disability conferences where we wanted to disseminate it. But I said to myself, you know, we really need to promote this around the holidays because that's when people think about entertaining more and having people over. We've got Thanksgiving, Christmas, Hanukkah, New Year's, Super Bowl parties coming up, you know, all those events where people gather together. So this is a great opportunity to promote it. Thank you.
You know, when you talk about being someone who has both personal and professional experience, that you use a wheelchair yourself, but that you've done research as an academic on the topic of accessibility. Is there anything that you've learned in your research that your own experience had not taught you?
I've learned that people experience their disabilities in many different ways, that some people are very comfortable discussing it, other people are not, but there is a very common human need, as you mentioned at the start here, to connect and to be part of gatherings and movements. And I think my research has underscored this, that people want to live in the community and they want to participate. And everyone needs help addressing those barriers so that everybody can participate.
Have you ever been able to accept an invitation thanks to a gesture that someone else extended to you that is memorable for you and was particularly touching?
Oh, absolutely. I have friends who keep a piece of plywood handy, and when I come to visit, the plywood is out there on the steps. This has happened where I live now, and when we lived in New York, back in New York, I had friends that had the dot plywood, and that was always at the steps when I came over. So, and things like moving furniture, having a place where I can easily get to the table for dinner, that those are common things that I've experienced that people do for me, and I appreciate it. But we need to spread the word that those can be done for many people.
Back to just a detail type question. When I think about a holiday gathering for a lot of people, we talked about the sit down dinner, but the other version of that is usually a buffet. And I'm thinking buffets might present particular challenges. Any advice on that? Because it's such a popular way of serving lots of people.
Sure it is. Well, one thing, and I encounter this in hotels more often, is that they will often have some of the food on a higher level in order to make more space. So having the food within reach is good. But I think in a private home where space is limited, I think most people are very willing to have some help in reaching things or putting a plate together. So I think that is probably not as much as a barrier as actually getting in and having a place to be there. But it's a good thing to think about.
One other tip before we go, of a subtler piece of advice beyond the entryway, beyond the seating arrangements.
Just be open to moving things in your home to make it welcoming. We like to decorate and have things in a fixed way, but it's less important how your home looks and more important that everybody be included.
So that's just a hosting philosophy, really.
Absolutely.
Well, Dot Neri, thank you so much. It's been really great having you.
Thank you so much. Have a great Thanksgiving.
You too. Dot has written a guide for making your home visitable this holiday season. We just tweeted it out from at KCURCST, and we'll also link to it when we post the audio from this conversation online at kcur.org/centralstandard. It'll be there for you by the end of the day. Dot joined us from the Research and Training Center on Independent Living at KU. And that's a wrap for today's show. Like I said, all of the content we had today, my fellow Kansans and the marching band story and our conversation about an accessible holiday gathering, all of that will be available, kcur.org. Holiday parties, marching bands, festive day tomorrow. The Thanksgiving story is about Indigenous people sharing food and knowledge with European settlers who hadn't figured out how to survive around here. At least that's how the story most of us heard goes. But how Indigenous is the Thanksgiving table as we know it? We'll learn about Indigenous food tomorrow at 10. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Melody Rowell with Suzanne Hogan, Coy Duggar, Chris Young, and intern Sophia Gillespie. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stick around for Up to Date next.